This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last night, a heated discussion over gun rights at the State House got even more heated. Proposed legislation would add restrictions on gun purchases and expand the requirement for background checks. Opponents packed the Capitol for a public hearing. Eddie Garcia of St. Johnsbury was among them, and he described why he thinks the bill is a threat to gun owners.
This, if passed, would be only the first step in an incremental war on the rights of law-abiding Vermonters. Article 16 of the Vermont Constitution is clear that the people have the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state. I don't propose to stand idly by and watch that chipped away at.
But supporters of the legislation say the rights of gun owners do not trump the rights of others to be protected. When introducing the bill last month, Chittenden County Senator Philip Baruth said that it would require Vermont courts to file in a national database the names of people it has found to be a danger to themselves or others. He thinks this would help prevent events like the mass shooting that occurred at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut.
That's one of the common denominators in these sorts of mass shootings. People who have been often adjudicated to be a danger to themselves or their communities, somehow still getting their hands on weapons. So one of the ideas behind this bill is to try to prevent that specific segment of person from coming up with a weapon.
Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to look at what the bill does and what it doesn't do, and we're going to talk a little bit about the motivations of some of the bill's supporters and detractors. One of the frustrations I have in these kinds of discussions is that it often seems like people are talking past one another instead of explaining transparently where they're coming from and sticking to the issue at hand. So I'm hopeful that we can have a productive discussion today. Some of that is up to our guests, but a lot of that is up to our listeners, to you who are thinking about these issues and sharing your thoughts. You can add to the conversation that's already been started on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. That number again, 1-800-639-2211. Think about what you believe would protect us and preserve the freedom and rights that Vermonters believe, some believe, are under threat. Again, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Ann Braden is the president of Gun Sense Vermont. Her organization supports the legislation. Hi, Ann. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chris Bradley is president of Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs. His organization opposes the bill. Chris, it's nice to have you with me as well.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
And we're here today in the Montpelier studio. So let's talk a little bit about this bill. And I'm actually going to read from the bill's summary, just so we have it out there to start this conversation, what the bill purports to do and aims to do. So it says, this bill proposes to, one, prohibit a person convicted of a violent crime from possessing a firearm. Two, require that a criminal background check be conducted on the proposed purchaser before a firearm may be sold, unless the sale is between immediate family members, by or to a law enforcement agency, or by or to a law enforcement officer or member of the U.S. Armed Forces acting within the course of his or her official duties. And number three, the law proposes to require the court administrator to report to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System established by the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act of 1993 when a person is A, subject to hospitalization order after a determination by a court that the person is a danger to himself or herself or others, or B, found not responsible for a crime by reason of insanity or incompetent to stand trial due to mental illness and is committed to the Department of Mental Health after a determination by a court that the person is a danger to himself or herself or others. That's a lot to take in, but I think it's important to have out there what the bill says it's going to do and what the aim of the bill is. And let me just clarify that first point, that issue of prohibiting a person convicted of a violent crime from possessing a firearm. There are already federal laws on the books that prevent most felons from legally owning a firearm if they've been convicted of a felony. This would codify state law on that issue. And Ann Braden, the idea is that it would give local law enforcement officers more of an ability to enforce that law. Why can't they already?
That's correct. So Vermont and Mississippi are actually the only two states in the whole country that don't have a state law prohibiting violent felons from possessing weapons. And so this is something where I don't think it was ever a conscious decision to not have state law. It just hasn't come up. But it's something where there's federal law, but that means that if a local law enforcement person finds a violent felon that has a weapon, they have to refer the case to the ATF. And that doesn't always get prosecuted. So this would you know, broaden the scope of who can prosecute those crimes.
Chris Bradley, do you have a problem with that part of the law?
Well, federal law is pretty clear. We have prohibited persons. There's a broad range of prohibited persons. If we take a look in Barrie, for example, the Barrie Police Department just found a prohibited person in possession of a firearm. They called the ATF, and from that point forward, there was a federal prosecutor, there's a federal court, there's a federal penitentiary, it's federal parole, federal. This takes, let's have the federal government do what they are supposed to be doing. And if, in fact, they are not prosecuting, then we need to press our congressional delegation to make sure they do prosecute those cases.
Why shouldn't state law enforcement be able to also enforce that law if it's on the books at a federal level?
State law enforcement can always separate a criminal from a firearm if in fact they're a prohibited person. So let's take that off the table. There's no ability for a felon to continue having a gun once they've been stopped by law enforcement. It's just a wiser use of Vermont tax dollars to have this be put on the federal government for prosecution.
Why is that not true, Anne?
The fact is that local prosecutors cannot prosecute these crimes unless there's a state law to rely on.
But so, Chris Bradley is saying let's leave it in the hands of federal prosecutors.
You know, I think that the the National Gun Lobby has done a very successful job of making sure that the ATF is not fully funded. And so we're in the situation where it's hard. They're understaffed. They're doing the best they can. But, you know, this is the situation where we are. And, you know, public safety is at stake.
Let's go to Madison, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Madison. Your thoughts.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. My general feeling on gun control, I'm really just making a brief statement that perhaps you can address or discuss, is the social, moral, and civic responsibility that we all have to ensure the safety of our family and others. We already have laws in place that if someone is convicted of a DWI, they no longer have access to a motor vehicle. And I agree that these kind of responsibilities should be put on all of us. Another instance is when someone does drive a vehicle, they have to insure and license that vehicle. I would suggest that we have the same sort of standards for a weapon that can kill people. It's just moral, civil, social responsibility that I wish we could have as a very fair discussion in being morally obligated to each other.
Madison, thank you for sharing your thoughts. If you'd like to add yours to the mix, listeners, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition. We're taking a look at legislation that affects gun purchases. It's up for debate in the Vermont legislature. And we're talking with Anne Braden, president of Gun Sense Vermont, and Chris Bradley, president of the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs. So what about Madison's thoughts there? Chris, I'll go to you first.
Well, let's first make sure, as we look at S-31, there's a distinction made between a sale of a firearm and essentially a loan of a firearm. At present, I can loan a gun under S-31 to anyone I saw fit. Now, that's putting the citizen, allowing them to use their good judgment in determining whether it should be acceptable to loan a gun. When we look at a sale, there's nothing today that prevents an honest seller from insisting that a background check be performed as a contingency of a sale. So I think you'll find that at least when one responsible citizen is selling to someone that they don't know, federal law puts a 10-year, $15,000 fine on that person if they sell to a prohibited person. I am therefore heavily incented to follow federal law, and if I have any question about the integrity or character of the buyer, there's nothing preventing me from insisting that a background check be done. So I have voluntary compliance today. And what S-31 is trying to do is mandate voluntary compliance.
Why is that a problem, though? If you're saying a responsible gun owner may do that on his or her own, what's the problem with having mandatory compliance?
It's actually quite simple. How we're talking about private sales. How do you enforce a private sale? How do you know when the private sale has even happened? How, after the fact, are you even going to know the law was broken? Quite simply, the only people that are going to follow this law are the law-abiding citizens of the state of Vermont, who, I must point out, are exactly the same people that we shouldn't have any concern over what they do with their firearms whatsoever. They are law-abiding citizens. So criminals aren't going to obey these laws. The black market, stolen guns, straw purchases, there's any number of ways, unfortunately, that an evil element can get their hands on guns. And it's not a gun show loophole. I have to stress this. At the State House last night, there were any number of supporters of this bill that seemed to think that gun shows are a cornucopia of buy whatever you want. And that is simply not the case. Anybody engaged in the sale of firearms by federal law has to do a background check. That's federal law. There's stiff penalties if they don't. And there's a bookkeeping that they have to record to turn over to the ATF when it's asked. This is a highly, highly regulated industry. If we take a look at the FFLs themselves.
Well, let me stop you because we're getting into a couple different things here. And yes, gun shows in Vermont, to clarify a point here that often is misinterpreted or misreported. If you're at a gun show, if you're in a gun show, there has to be a background check. In Vermont, you cannot sell a gun in a gun show and not go through a background check.
If you are dealing with a dealer, a background check is mandated.
However, if you go to your house and somebody comes over and you conduct a private transaction, right now you are not required to have a background check on the purchaser of that gun in a private transaction between two people who are not licensed gun dealers. And that's one of the parts of this law that would change. This law would require private gun sales to also go through the background check process.
This was heavily debated by Congress in the passing of the Gun Control Act of 1968. There was never a loophole. This is something that's irritating to gun owners. There was never a loophole, as if something existed and nefarious people found a way around it.
It wasn't required.
Private sales, and again, this was taken up in the Brady Bill of 1993. Private sales are left to the good judgment of the people involved for a very good reason. Honest citizens are going to be very conscious. I don't ever want one of my guns to end up in the hands of criminals, and I somewhat resent the implication that I would just sell to anybody. A criminal will sell to anybody. They're outside the law already.
Okay, so Ann Braden, what about that point? Because, you know, to Chris's point, people who are already law-abiding citizens and who are conscientious gun owners will or should, and or in his thoughts, are only selling to other conscientious law-abiding citizens. So what are you getting by requiring a background check on a private gun sale?
Well, I think there's two things here, two points that need to be made. One is that when this sort of whole debate has happened at the federal level, 1968 and then in 1993, the internet did not exist in the form that it does now. You know, we're not just talking about people meeting up with their neighbors. We're talking about unlicensed online sales.
But if you sell a gun on the internet and cross state lines, you still have to go through a background check.
Right, but within the state, you know, VermontArmsList.com, you know, you go on there and you can even search for private sales and come up with a list of sellers that are not going to require a background check. And, those are anonymous sales, and you know, you have to meet up in a parking lot to actually conduct the sale. Why not meet up at a gun dealer to do the background check at the same time? You know, if you look at in Colorado, the first 6 months that they passed this law in 2013, I believe, in the first 6 months, there had been 122 people who had been denied a gun, who were prohibited individuals because of an unlicensed sale background check. So this is something where it's...
What do you mean? There were 122 who were found to be... what's the number?
Sorry, 122 people were denied access to a gun because...
In a background check, because they were already prohibited.
Right, because a background check was conducted, and that background check would not have been conducted before.
So for you, the main idea here, the thing that you're trying to prevent, are these sales that are occurring between people who may not know each other, not necessarily the people that Chris is talking about who know each other and know whether they are good citizens.
Right. I mean, there's a wide variety of private sales, unlicensed sales happening, and it just makes sense that all gun sales should be treated the same way.
But if somebody wants to conduct a private gun sale beyond the realm of law, what in this bill is going to prevent them from doing that?
The bill won't prevent them, but because it's if it became law, it would have consequences so that the law enforcement can actually enforce the consequences. I mean, that's why, you know, criminals don't, if we don't, if we believe that criminals don't obey the laws, why do we have laws about murder? I mean, we have a legal system for a reason. You know, most people follow the laws, but some people don't. That's why we have laws in place so that there can be consequences when someone goes beyond it. And in terms
But Chris is saying that somebody who sells a gun to a criminal who then uses that gun in a crime, the person who sold the gun is already potentially on the hook. So what makes this law better?
Well, this is really a way to enforce it.
How?
If you are required to go through to have a background check conducted, people can ask for proof of that background check. You know, it's just a very tangible piece. You know, you can say, well, I thought he was fine. But this is saying, no, you need to go further than that and make sure that, you know, that when the name goes into the database, it comes back, it's being approved. And so it's giving the federal law a mechanism to actually be enforced in a tangible, practical way.
So, Chris, again, what's the problem with that? And if you're a law-abiding citizen selling a gun to another law-abiding citizen, and if you were doing it at a gun show or if you were doing it at a gun shop, you'd have to go through a background check process. What's the problem?
I have gone through numerous background checks. I have purchased guns. I'm not familiar with Arms List, but there's a gun broker that I have purchased guns. As soon as that gun travels interstate, it is not allowed by federal law to be shipped to me. It has to be shipped to an FFL, at which point I go to that FFL and do a background check.
If you're crossing state lines.
What we're talking about is two different types of sales. Sales happening between honest and law-abiding citizens who are going to follow federal law if they know what's good for them. And I certainly don't see the reason for a redundant law. Especially if we're going to put a redundant law with absolutely no funding in it for our own law enforcement. I mean,
but if what Ann is saying about what happened in Colorado, for example, that occasionally you weed out people who should not have a gun, why isn't that good enough to require everybody to have to do it?
How do you enforce that happens? How do you? This is the type of sale that can happen over the internet through two people that don't even know each other. Or this can happen over a kitchen table between two lifelong friends. Why? In one instance, you're asking the citizen of Vermont to exercise his good judgment as to whether he wants to lend a gun to a lifelong friend or an acquaintance. Somehow that good judgment goes out the window if we're selling. Why, if I've known a person all my life and he can pass a background check all day and I can as well, do both of us have to be inconvenienced, pay some sort of fee that we don't even know what it is? And frankly, similar to gas prices, I think we need to look at how many FFLs are actually going to support enacting these sales, because I think you're going to find that a number of them won't, and some of them absolutely won't. When we're talking about Walmarts or Dick's Sporting Goods, I find it, both of which sell guns and who are FFLs, I find it very hard to believe that those stores are going to allow honest citizens to walk into their stores with guns and say, here, I'd like to sell this to that person.
Maybe not, but there's certainly room for other FFLs who would be willing to do it. A lot of independent ones already do that
kind of private sale.
That
exists today. There's nothing preventing federal law, state law, from if a seller has any concern about the buyer today, they're free to go to an FFL. It's voluntary compliance today. So we're going to mandate voluntary compliance?
Yeah, I guess so. If the law goes through, that is exactly what
it would do. And so the logical consequence of that is law-abiding citizens who will obey the law will, in fact, follow this law. Criminal sales versus honest sales. This law will not touch at all a criminal being able to get a gun.
Ann says it already has in Colorado.
I'm sorry. This is Vermont. Colorado's statistics and Colorado's demographics are entirely different from Vermont. It is.
But you can look to an example of another state that's enacted legislation to see how it might work here.
Let's look at how 594 has been H-594 is being received in Washington. H-594 was, in fact, the bill that I believe Ms. Braden would have really liked to see passed in Vermont. That bill is so egregious that, frankly, if anybody wants to look at the civil disobedience that's going on in Washington State right now, it's rather appalling. The fact of the matter is that you cannot stop a criminal from getting guns. Drugs are smuggled into this country. The ones that are interdicted run in the thousands of metric tons, and that's a percentage. If there's money to be made in selling something illegal, you can't stop a criminal from getting it. And I have to come back. Our best defense against a criminal element is an armed citizen.
This is a good point sort of philosophically where you stand on these issues, and I want to get into that. But I want to make sure that we get the callers in here, too, because there are a lot of people who have thoughts on this. A couple of emails that have come in. Nancy in Townsend says, it doesn't have to be one side against the other. Responsible Vermont gun owners are interested in gun safety, and all it would take to make our state adopt this bill is to understand that Vermonters are not the problem. It's the drugs for guns that take place in our state because of this loophole. S31 would unite all Vermonters who value freedom to own guns and simply introduce a step in the purchase of a firearm to weed out those who cause harm to them. Dave says, the bulk of the testimony in favor of this bill last night did not even pertain to issues having occurred in Vermont. Indiana and Alaska or New York is where these violent incidents occurred, proving what opponents of this bill believe. This is not a Vermont problem. In many of these stories, if the victims had been armed, the outcome would have been very different. Linda in Dummerston says, this is a common sense bill that seeks to require background checks for gun sales. Law-abiding citizens do not have any reason to fear this bill. The argument that passing any legislation which puts any limit on gun sales needs to be defeated because it will lead to further restrictions is designed to incite gun proponents to fear their guns will be taken away. This bill is designed to make it more difficult for criminals, known abusers, and gun traffickers to purchase guns. And let's go to John, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm a convicted federal felon. Years ago, I tried to take my life with a shotgun I owned, and I had sawed the barrel off, and that was against ATF law. Of course, I'm still alive. I was subdued. I didn't die by suicide by cop. My question is, I know the federal system because I was sent away for 44 months, not for trying to take my life because I had mental illness, but because the shotgun I had altered it, and I didn't go to the ATF and register it and have a gunsmith alter the weapon. My point is, we already have federal laws on that say if a state felon in Vermont possesses any type of firearm, whether he's not going to do anything bad with it, wants to hunt deer or hunt a squirrel, that's a federal offense. He will be arrested. The state will hand him over to the ATF. And far as I know, because I just got off federal supervision, the ATF is doing well. And the state always hands over a state felon or a federal felon if they're caught with a rifle, shotgun, handgun, whatever. I think we're wasting taxpayers' money by bringing up this legislature. Our state is in debt for $110 million. They should be working on issues dealing with our economy, substance abuse, the heroin problem, and other things.
John, right, I take your point. Thank you for making it, and thanks for calling in. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking about gun legislation that's on the table in Montpelier, and we're getting your reaction to it. If you have a question or a thought you'd like to share, you can post it at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition, or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today about proposed legislation on gun ownership with Ann Braden, president of Gun Sense Vermont. Her group strongly supports legislation in Montpelier. Chris Bradley is president of the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs. His group opposes it. We're getting their takes, but also hearing from some of you. And if you have a thought you'd like to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Again, 800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Scott, calling in from Burlington. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
As Ann Braden pointed out, laws do not prevent a criminal from breaking the law. This law, as we see it, the gun-owning people of Vermont, see it as the camel's nose under the tent. We see a natural progression of laws across the country where a simple, quote, common sense law is enacted, and then it is expanded to fit the ultimate goal of the people that proposed it. We've seen this in California, New York, Maryland, Connecticut, other places. They enacted an ineffective law that cannot be enforced. Then in the future, the law is tweaked. This law could easily be tweaked. Once a background check on the private level is required, the next step would be to require the dealer, the FFL, to supply the names of both parties and the specifics of the firearm to the Department of Public Safety, which then would create the state registry so that they can check to make sure that this law is being complied with. Next, we see increasing restrictions as far as licensing and the prohibition of certain classes of weapons by cosmetic characteristics. Once the state has a database, they then go back to the populace in search of the weapons that fit that criteria. This is not a conspiracy theory of gun owners. We see this happening across the country in rapid succession. In California, it took 40 years for this to happen. In New York, it took about 20 years from 1994 to 2014.
Scott, I see where you're going here, and let me stop you because I want to make sure we get in Ann Braden and Chris Bradley on this. You know, one of the questions here is, so if this bill passes, what happens next? And Ann Braden, I'd like to get from you and from your position as the president of Gun Sense, is this bill the ultimate for you, or do you have in mind things like a gun registry or further restrictions that you would prefer to see? What's your philosophical position on the rights of gun owners in this state?
Well, I think that law-abiding citizens in Vermont have a very clear right to bear arms, and I completely support that. And I think that as an organization, we are focused only on those who have already been prohibited by law for possessing firearms. You know, dangerous felons, convicted abusers, drug traffickers. That's who we're focused on. So, you know, last night there was a lot of people talking about how they were afraid that the government was going to come confiscate their guns. And, you know, I'm not for government confiscation. Like, I'm against that, too. But that's not what this bill is about. You know, this bill is about very specifically, very narrowly drawn.
But is that because you think that's all that would pass, or is that what you want? What's in this bill? Are you done? Does Gun Sense Vermont dissolve after this bill is passed?
Well, this, I think what Gun Sense Vermont is focused on is keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. You know, I think that there is, there's a very clear line. You know, federal law says certain people are prohibited. Law-abiding citizens are not prohibited. You know, what we're focused on has nothing to do with the rights of law-abiding citizens.
Chris Bradley, I know you want to jump in there.
Ms. Braden, I think that's a little disingenuous. The website last year had a laundry list of things that you wanted to accomplish. I think S31 is a very simple. I think the question was, what else did Gun Sense want to accomplish? I think it's well beyond S31, isn't it?
Well, if you look at the progression of our organization, you know, we got started in March of 2013. We began by talking to gun owners and seeing, okay, where is the common ground on this issue? What is the middle ground? Because this issue does not have to be polarizing. You know, I really believed that we did not have to approach it in a way that was going to be pro-gun or anti-gun. You know, Vermont has a very strong gun-owning community, and it's a good tradition. I mean,
But just to put a fine point on it, because mm-hmm. we don't have a ton of time, and I want to get to that fine point, and then, Chris, I want to get to the fine point for you as well. But so, what do you want ultimately in terms of what laws should be on the books to get to your goal of protecting Vermonters and preventing guns from being in the hands of people who shouldn't have them, in your view?
I think that what we've proposed is a really strong common ground approach. And so I feel like, I mean, there's...
I feel like you're not answering the question.
Well, I think it's in part because I haven't even thought beyond. I mean, we as an organization, we haven't even thought beyond this. You know, this is just about how can we keep guns out of the hands of criminals and the mentally ill. I mean, like, it's not, we have many gun owners in our organization, and our philosophical push is to find that common ground so that it's not a polarizing issue. And so that is, I mean, that is guiding everything that we're doing.
Okay, so Chris Bradley, though, let me ask you, I mean, do you think that there should be restrictions on gun ownership in this country, and specifically because we're talking about state laws in Vermont?
There are inches thick.
That's not what I'm asking. Do you believe that we should just have no restrictions? I mean, if you're worried about impingement here and more restrictions and more background checks that are required for law-abiding citizens, if you had your choice, would you just repeal all of the restrictions? I mean, what's the point for you in terms of the rights of gun owners versus the ability to try to prevent people who should not have guns, and there's some agreement on that, from getting guns?
There's no question. I think any honest and law-abiding citizen does not want hands in the guns of prohibited people. Period.
So how do we
start
do
your
that?
Sentence. Start. I think Ann touched upon it. She suggested that there was a problem with federal prosecution. Let's fix that problem. We have a congressional delegation. This is our tax dollars that we've already paid. Where are we getting our money's worth out of this? A redundant law is redundant. There's not a need for it. You've got a loaded question there, because basically,
sure,
if you want to go back in terms of history and what our founding fathers wanted, I mean, I've heard they were only talking about muskets. No, what they were talking about was that the honest citizen should be able to have access to the types of small arms used in the wars of the day. Certainly, we have all sorts of restrictions. For example, you used to be able to buy a Thompson submachine gun through Sears and Roebuck. There weren't mass killings there. You could buy silencers down at your local hardware store.
You can still buy a Tommy gun in one of the independent gun shops in Vermont.
Well, a little known fact is actually you can legally own a machine gun in the state of Vermont.
Yes.
So just to
my point in this idea, I mean, I know that, and certainly we could debate the founding fathers, because that's another debate that happens, whether they're talking about a well-organized militia or people to have the right to bear arms to have in their homes. But just for right now, I mean, do you see a middle ground here for some restrictions that are common sense and that do help to prevent criminals from obtaining guns that you support? Or do you think that restrictions should be lifted?
Well, as an organization that has existed in Vermont since 1875, I don't believe the Federation has been approached by any group, as opposed to individual gun owners, as to what our stance is until well after the fact. I mean, Chap Smith said last year that we were going to have a dialogue on this. We haven't had that dialogue. Apparently, we're having it now, and it's requiring the honest citizens of Vermont to actually go to the State House and then be underreported as to how many people showed up in the media. It's somewhat appalling. I mean, we have a media engine against us. If anybody takes a look at the lobbying effort that Gun Sense Vermont put in last year, $78,000. And I'd really like to ask Ann Braden where that money came from.
Well, I'm afraid we don't have time for that now, because
doesn't
we are out
me.
Of time. But, you know, I would take umbrage to the idea that VPR in particular is not being fair, is not being balanced, and is not actually looking at this issue from multi-sides. We certainly have done it on this program in the past and continue to do so. But I really appreciate both of you being here today, because it is important to talk through these issues for people to be able to understand where they come down on it. So Ann Braden with Gun Sense Vermont and Chris Bradley with the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs, thank you both very much for being on the program today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to find out a little bit about the shadow budget. There's a lot of grumbling about high taxes in Vermont, but the state actually leaves $1 billion on the table that it could be collecting from businesses and individuals. We're going to explain that just a minute on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's been a lot of talk lately about the $100 million budget gap the Vermont legislature is trying to close. Some lawmakers are calling for increased taxes or revenues. Others look for cuts to existing programs, and many are seeing room for both. But it turns out the state forgoes way more than that each year by not collecting taxes on certain items that it could plausibly tax. Known as tax expenditures, there are about $1 billion that stay in the pockets of individuals and businesses instead of in state accounts. In a special report called The Shadow Budget, VPR has looked into this money. We asked data reporter Hillary Niles to explain some of what she uncovered, starting with the basics. What is a tax expenditure?
Sure. It does sound like kind of an obscure term. But basically, what it is a tax break. It can take various forms, either a tax credit or a deduction, or an exemption from a particular tax, or a lower tax rate that somebody might pay. But what it comes down to is that state policymakers, and this happens in every state, it's definitely not just Vermont. So state policymakers say, okay, here's tax A, but we don't want everyone to have to pay it. Or here's tax B, but we're not going to apply it to every transaction. And generally speaking, these tax breaks are given either as a matter of fairness or perceived fairness or as a way to encourage certain activity. And so the tax breaks add up to money that the state technically does not collect because the policymakers feel like they get more value out of not collecting the tax than they would from collecting it.
And the state gives up about $1 billion annually that it could collect in taxes?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It is about a billion with a B. And just for comparison, that is not too far from Vermont's general fund budget. So it is a sizable amount.
What industries or categories are the biggest beneficiaries of these tax breaks?
Well, manufacturers are definitely the biggest beneficiary, and that's a really broadly defined group in this context. It can be anything from aerotech to cottage industry. But the idea is that the raw materials that manufacturers use to put together into a finished product, those are not taxed because the idea is the product is taxed at the retail level as a finished product. So exempting the purchase of the raw materials and certain equipment that goes into producing the product avoids essentially taxing that end product at multiple stages of its production. So in that regard, manufacturers are definitely the biggest beneficiary. It was valued at about $340 million in fiscal year 2014. The next biggest expenditure, but nowhere near as big, is the so-called income sensitivity adjustment for property taxes.
Mm-hmm. And this is one that would affect individual taxpayers.
Exactly, yeah. So folks below a certain income threshold on their property taxes, instead of paying their property taxes based on the value of their property, they pay into the statewide education fund as a tax rate against their income. That weighs in at about $100 million per year. But one thing to note is that both that manufacturer's equipment and materials exemption and the property tax adjustment for income sensitivity, technically, the state is no longer reporting those as tax expenditures. There are a handful of items that are now, starting with the 2015 report, there are a handful of items that are no longer reported as tax expenditures.
Why not?
Well, there are a few reasons. One is if there's something that is considered an alternative tax structure, they're now considering that, well, it's not really an expenditure, it's an alternative tax structure.
So what are a couple of other categories that they are still reporting?
The earned income tax credit is definitely one. Also, one that folks might not be aware of is that there's clothing and footwear. There's a tax break for clothing and footwear, similar to the reasoning behind not taxing, you know, basic groceries and food, is that you need clothing to keep yourself, you know, warm and decent when you're out in public, right? Mm-hmm. And so most clothing and footwear is not taxed. Some other examples, there are property taxes, there are expenditures and exemptions for agricultural inputs, for medical products. You know, one other is municipally owned property. So there's sort of a principle of the government not taxing itself.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that, as far as the income and individual tax breaks goes, capital gains exclusions.
So, Hillary, I mean, some of the ones that you've mentioned, those ideas that it's just sort of culturally inappropriate to tax people for a basic necessity like food, those seem really rooted in historical or cultural priorities. But are other categories more the work of lobbyists, you know, trying to work to get tax breaks for certain sectors of the population?
I would imagine so. Like you said, some of them are just sort of a matter of cultural values. Some of the tax breaks go back, especially a handful of the property tax breaks, go back to the founding of the state in 1791. Others have been put on the books more recently. There was a property tax break added in 2004 for ski lifts and snowmaking equipment. In 2011, the state instituted a tax break for sales by licensed auctioneers. And there really are so many dozens of these tax breaks that it's kind of fascinating to imagine some of the conversations that went into each and every one.
Hillary, I don't think there are any lawmakers who are actually suggesting that Vermont revoke all of these benefits, you know, all at once, wholesale, revoke them. But just hypothetically, if we did, would the state actually automatically see that $1 billion come right back to it?
That is a great question and a very important question, because the thing to know about this, and when you're looking at the value, is that it definitely is a lot of value, right? Approximately $1 billion. But when the tax breaks are studied, they're studied in isolation, one at a time, based on best available data and educated estimations, sometimes on really hard specific data. But they're studied one at a time. But they don't exist in isolation. They exist in the larger society and in the larger, broader economy. And so if you change any one of them, then you're most likely going to initiate a ripple effect in the broader economy, in the broader society. And it's really hard to say what the impact of that ripple effect could be. And so when we go back to the very idea of these tax expenditures, or the decision by policymakers to institute a tax break for a certain activity because they want to encourage certain commercial activity that they feel like is good for the state and good for the economy. Well, if you were to take away one of those tax breaks, you don't know how that would end up affecting that industry or having the effect of discouraging that activity. And so it could end up being a wash. It could potentially also end up being a net loss to the state. And so it's really important to remember that there's not a direct line between the $1 billion of foregone revenue and any hypothetical amount of money that could be gained from changing or eliminating any of the tax expenditures.
Right, because just thinking of an example here, if I suddenly had to pay taxes on my groceries, I might have less money in my budget to go out to dinner, and so the state's not collecting that rooms and meals tax. So it's not like it's necessarily just an added $1 billion just from collecting those taxes.
Exactly. It's not like the state could have its cake and eat it too.
How hard was it for you to find all of this information, and why do you think it's important? I mean, you mentioned that some of these categories aren't even calculated in the same way anymore. So why do you think we need to know?
Yeah. In terms of why we need to know, one of the reasons, it's very clear that the tax expenditures budget, if you will, doesn't get the same level of scrutiny that the direct spending does. So even though it's at $1 billion, not too far away from the state's general fund budget of direct spending, these tax breaks are on the books and these exist. They don't get reexamined every year. They don't have to come up for reapproval every year. And they don't get as much attention and scrutiny. That said, there has been an effort to pay more attention to them. And so as far as accessing the data, I had the advantage, really, I went to the state's biennial reports that have been issued more or less since 2006, where the Joint Fiscal Office and the Tax Department and others within the state have collaborated to try to put some figures onto these tax expenditures. I will say that that is helpful. These reports exist. However, the way that those reports are issued does not make them very accessible for analysis. You can sort of read the reports and read the numbers, but it did take a fair amount of legwork to take those numbers and put them into a spreadsheet so that you could do the type of analysis that we were undertaking with this shadow budget project. So that the idea being to sort of bring this indirect spending or indirect expenditures, if you will, sort of out of the shadows and help people understand a little bit more clearly why these tax expenditures are state policy, and then evaluate whether or not the state is getting the value that was behind the idea of instituting them in the first place.
That's reporter Hillary Niles, who reported this story, The Shadow Budget, with VPR's Taylor Dobbs. Hillary, thank you very much for explaining it for us.
Thank you, Jane. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
And you can read the story and examine the extensive charts and data that go with it. It's all at vpr.net. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we are in the red and pink grip of Valentine's Day. We'll take three looks at love with a sociologist who studies relationships, a professional matchmaker, and a Vermont Folklife Center project that captures stories of love. Join us for that tomorrow, if you can swallow it, at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Singeri, with production assistance from Devin Karambolis. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.